everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening from wherever and whenever you're listening. This is your girl, Omolayo, with my friend, Nana, and we're bringing you another episode of the Afropolitan Central.
Hey guys, how's it going? As Omolayo said, we have a really exciting episode for you guys this time. We're talking about African fashion, whatever that means.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I almost want to like say it like in quotes whenever I say like, you know, the term African fashion, because it's like there's just so much to it.
Yeah, so I think we're using the term African fashion here to be a bit general, but forgive us, you understand as we go through it. So in kind of brainstorming this, we thought it would be really interesting to put the spotlight on our personal journeys with African print, or, you know, our local prints in our various countries, and then also turn that lens to the global relationship with, you know, various prints like coming out of the African continent, be it Ankara, be it traditional prints in southern parts of the continent, etc., etc., because we thought there'd be very interesting nuggets buried in all these areas for us to explore. So that's what we're talking about today. Yay!
I know. I'm excited. So personally for me, like, if we're just gonna like just to jump right into it.
Yeah.
Personally for me, I've had a really interesting relationship with African fashion my whole life, just because I think I've always embraced it. I don't think I've ever had a time in my life where I like rejected it or wasn't interested in it or anything of that nature. So like most of you know, I grew up in the US. So we left Nigeria at about when I was about turning 7. And then I grew up here, and for me, like, not that I didn't wear African print to school all the time. First of all, I think I went to a school where we wore a uniform, but like a few Sundays I would wear African print to church or whatever. And then once I did get to high school, so secondary school, I wore the few Ankara pieces that I had whenever we had special events. So for me, Ankara pieces and African fashion prints was like a special event kind of thing, because most of like a lot of my nice dresses or my like, you know, my church dresses would be print, and so there wasn't anything that I would like wear that was like, oh, like a cute Ankara top that I would wear to school on a regular basis. So for me at the beginning, like, I've always loved African print, and it represented like when I got to dress up for church or an event or things of that nature. So that was my relationship with it from like, you know, 7 on through high school. And then high school senior year prom, I remember I told my mom and dad, I was like, I want to wear African print for prom, like, and my parents were just like so proud. I remember I think I told my mom the idea first, and then like she had later told my dad, and my dad was like, oh wow, like, really, you want to wear African? Like, that's really awesome, like, I'm really proud of you, that's a great idea, showcasing your culture at prom and things like that. So my parents were like, guys, really excited.
Yeah, you guys, her prom dress is the bob. And this girl, I tell you, little fashionista that she is, she has these like really like dramatic and very like model-esque photos where she's like sitting like on a beach or like on some rock somewhere, posing with the dress.
My brother came home at that time, and like he had just got into photography. Like, now my brother is like a fashion and wedding photographer, and so like he was just starting when I decided to when I was getting to like Ankara print to that level, so it kind of like worked out for the two of us. I got to like do my model posing, and then my brother got to take photos. And so at this time, this was like in 2011, so like that was like before Instagram and everything, so like it wasn't, because I know like now we have that like hashtag that's like Ankara to prom or whatever, and you see a lot of people like balling out. So first of all, number one, I lived in a small town, like barely any other black kids, let alone African kids. And secondly, like, African print was like not something that was on the global stage. I remember like even when I was like trying to like design my dress, and I was googling different dresses and stuff, like the same 5 photos kept on coming up.
Oh, gosh.
And so like they were just like, it just wasn't out there yet, the fact that, you know, people wore Ankara on a regular basis or to anything other than African weddings, right? And so we were able to like find a local designer here in the DC area who had like made my dress and everything, and it was beautiful, it was gorgeous, I loved it. So that's kind of been my history with it. And then ever since then, so that was high school, and then from then on, like, we started going to Nigeria a little bit more often. Like, we didn't go to Nigeria much, like, throughout my entire time, like, mostly growing up here. And then after that, we started going to Nigeria a little bit more, and I was getting more clothes made and things like that. And then from there, I started incorporating African print into, like, my daily wear. So I would get, like, skirts made and shorts made and tops made. So I could wear it in my daily attire. So, yeah, and that's how I've been ever since.
Yeah.
How about you, Alex? In your relationship with
my relationship African. Yeah, I think it's been similar yet different in several ways. So for me, grew up in Ghana, only moved to the US when I was 18. And so for me, like, our traditional ntoma, which is as we call it, ntoma is just cloth in chi. It's always been like a part of us, in the sense that, for instance, like Christmas, normally there would be some sort of trip to like the local seamstress down the street, get your measurements done, etc. For like your Christmas dress, some aspect of like your Christmas attire. So it was always, you know, something to look forward to. So yeah, for like boarding school, for instance, we had church on Sundays, and you had to wear like your local, like a traditional wear. So normally for girls, it was like your kaba and slit. So your kaba is like your top made out of ntoma. Your slit is like your long skirt with like a slit. And so, you know, that's another way where it was just a mainstay in like my wardrobe to be able to have that. But I think for me, so it's been one of those things where it's always been there. Like, it's always been a part of my wardrobe. It's always been a part of my fashion sense, but it hasn't been anything personal. Like, oh my gosh, like, this is me, like, you know, expressing myself and expressing my identity. Okay. It was just always a part of it. But then definitely when I moved to the US, where obviously, you know, none of these events or none of these situations were still there and to require me to wear my prints, I was like, oh, okay. So this is a little piece of home with me. So if I wore, like, you know, my dress that I had gotten made, or top and jeans or whatever, people would be like, oh my gosh, like, blah, blah, blah. And so it was very much like, oh, this is me, like, expressing, you know, my culture and my identity. And so it came to have like more meaning, and it's been the same since then, I think, just because I've stayed in the West. So now, there is no trip back home that doesn't involve me going to the seamstress or tailor. Yes, like,
and what is that like? Tell me a little bit. I know, like, I have a few tailor stories, but definitely tell me a little bit about it,
y'all. So, I, whenever I'm wearing my prints, people are like, oh my gosh, blah, 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 this is so cute. I'm like, yeah, I got it made for like $10 or £5 or whatever. Because, you know, that is definitely like a luxury that we have, right? Being able to get your clothes like custom made. And I am petite with a tiny waist, short, like, that sounded a little weird, didn't it? the emphasis is on just me being petite, and so it's hard for me to shop for clothes. So
proportions is hard to find in a regular store. Yeah. And I can't really get that, like,
moving on quite quickly, it's quite hard to just find things that fit me correctly.
And like, so, off the rack, exactly.
Yeah, and so just the luxury of just being able to, you know, get that made. But you guys, all tailors and seamstresses are not made equal. Like, shout out to, you know, all the tailors and seamstresses back home, but you know there are some of them, so you'll show them a style and they're like, oh yeah, 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 I can totally see this. They will not ask you for the picture to keep. They will not, you know, ask for, sketch it out or anything. They're like, yeah, 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 I know this. I will make it for you. And then you come back to pick up your attire.
And you're like, what is this?
You're like, what is this? This
exactly. For me, I like drawing out my design. Oh. So I always, like, leave it with them. So I'm like, this is the picture I drew, and so this is what you're going to make. But it's not always what I pick up.
Oh my,
my main thing with tailors back home is just, like, the time. Like, I just feel like a lot of tailors back home, like, aren't serious about themselves. Like, they'll tell, like, you know what I mean? Like, you know you have 10 customers, and instead of you to be honest with me and be like, I can't have this done until 2 weeks from now, you'd be like, oh, pick it up, you know, next week. And I come next week and you haven't even cut my fabric. Like, so for me, like, I don't even mind, like, you know, if it takes a month or whatever, as long as you do good work. But like, I don't like it that you, like, you know, lie to me about whenever it's ready. And so I had this, like, awful experience with a tailor in Abuja who was making my khaki trousers for me for my NYSC service. And so I just asked, and for me, I already had khaki trousers, but I wanted one with, like, a darker green fabric. So I asked him to make it for me. And so for me, like, I already had a khaki fabric. So, like, I wanted him to take as much time as he needed. So he was like, no, 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 like, just tell me when you want to pick it up. I was like, okay, fine, let me pick up next Friday. And so next Friday comes and goes. I go to his office, go to his shop, and he's like, oh, I haven't started. Come back tomorrow, blah, 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 or something like that. All I know is that I ended up going back to his shop like 3 or 4 times, and I almost cursed this person out. And I'm not an angry person.
Oh, gosh.
And that was the thing for me. Like, it wasn't even like that big a deal that it took that long. But if you had just been upfront with me in the first place, because I wasted so much money showing up at your shop for only for it not to be ready. But if you would just have picked up your calls and been honest with me, like, it would have been cool. So for me, that's just the thing I don't like.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? But I feel like, I think it just adds the experience. Like, there is obviously loads and loads and loads of room for, like, improvement. And, like, I will say, for instance, like, in Ghana, for instance, like, some of the tailors and seamstresses in Accra, like, it is on another level, like, the level of professionalism there. So, so, obviously.
Yeah, I have this tailor in Ondo and another one in Dakar. And those two are, like, some of the best tailors I've ever seen anywhere. Like, their quality is always on point.
Yeah.
Like, and they're actually timely. Like, they're honest about their time. And they're professional with all their clients. So, like, they tell you, like, oh, I have 3 other people right now, so yours will get made till XYZ. So, like, for me, like, it's definitely a hit or miss. Once you find that good tailor, hold on to them.
Yep, don't let them go. Don't let them go. Like, I've seen people on Instagram, like, asking, oh, who's your tailor? And then the person responds, like, nope, not sharing. So, it is...
It is that deep sometimes.
But, yeah, so...
And then, speaking of Instagram, I just feel like Instagram has really helped with, like, the rise of African fashion on a global stage.
Yeah, I think social media in general, right? Because we were talking about this earlier, that for us growing up, we weren't necessarily, like, we obviously... Obviously, we know, like, our local prints, we know our Ankara, we know our Ntoma, blah, blah, blah. But seeing it represented on international stages weren't something that we... Of course, we're not here to say, like, we never saw it, because that would be a lie. But I was also like, huh, I'm sure there were things. And I was like, huh, I can't think of any designer back then that... that was represented. But I think in the age of social media, like, has kind of changed that, in the sense that, like, you know, another... You know, somebody back home in Nigeria is wearing, like, a really cool design. You're like, whoa, I want that. You're getting that made. Somebody in LA is wearing something. You're like, oh, my gosh, that looks so hip. Like, I want... So it's just... It's bridged that gap, and it's given us a platform for it to be center stage. And it's
right. Also, it's more accessible too, because it used to be that you could only get it if you, like, you know, had a reason to travel back to Africa. Like, whether it's Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, like, the only time you got African fabric. But now you see a lot of local designers in, like, London or even here in the DMV. Yeah. I know, like, a handful of people who make the clothing. Price tag is a little bit different, but the quality is also a little bit different. Like, that one's a little bit more, it's a little less hit than this. So, like, yeah, the price tag is different because of, you know, the economy is different, the manufacturing process is different, but you're short quality.
Exactly.
And it makes, like, those Ankara print, those fabric, more accessible to people who, like, maybe live in London, live in LA, live in DC, but don't get to go back often.
As often, exactly. And I think it's also been really good in terms of, like, helping us, like, find designers, like Omalaya has said, because there have been, like, lots of really cool, like, little initiatives and, like, little, like, stories here and there. So, like, something like Zuva, for instance, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. It's, like, a platform that connects all kinds of local designers onto one. So, it's basically, like, what? Like an Amazon or so of, like, African fashion.
Yeah, I actually bought my graduation dress from them. I don't know if you remember. Remember my graduation dress? That one with the tulle under?
Yeah.
So I bought it from Zuva. So, oh my gosh, I wish I remembered the name of the... I'm going to find the name of the designer. So So basically, like, what I did was, like, you know, it's a digital platform. So I was able to just, like, look through the dresses, and I found one that I liked, and I ordered it. And it's like, yeah, I made the order through Zuva, but the order goes through that designer. Mm-hmm. And then she made me the dress and then shipped it to me in time for graduation. So, mm-hmm. like, Zuva. And then there's other marketplaces like that, too, like Miss Cabby. She's this lady who's Toronto-based. I met her in New York one time. So that's another platform where they have, like, a bunch of different designers. A place like Nubian Human. That's another website where there's, like, different African prints and designs and other stuff that you can, like, buy directly from them. The Hot Salute is another one that I know. So there's definitely, like, a lot that are popping up. But I know, for example, like, Kalechi, who was the person that started Zuva, like, she was really good about, like, using social media to, like, promote African prints and designs. And so, you know, what she would do is, like, on her social media platform, she would, like, daily, she was, like, posting different designers and their prints and everything, and just, like, building a social media following before the Zuva marketplace was even ready. And another person in the area who did that was it's not African prints and fashion, but, like, she, Nikki Billie Jean, she was also another one where she had, like, a curated, I think she started on Tumblr, and she was just, like, posting different African designs, and she used that to, like, really generate interest, and she gained a huge following. And now I think she, like, she designs outfits on her own, and she's had, like, you know, the African fashion show here in DC and things like that. So people have been really using social media to just, like, promote African print and make it more. I don't think I want to use normal, but, like, more of the everyday. And then another person would be Diana Opoti. I think I'm pronouncing that right. She's from Kenya. And she did, like, 100 Days of Ankara campaign, where she showed, like, 100 different ways to, like, and she's, like, a fashion consultant and stylist and stuff like that, and so she was able to show, like, different ways to wear African print on, like, for 100 days straight. So there's all these different people who, like, been really good about, like, quote-unquote normalizing African fashion, but more so, like, bringing it on a global stage and making it be, like, this isn't something we just wear for special events and, like, weddings and stuff. This is something that we wear to work, we wear daily. And so, personally for me, like that, and, you know, you as well, when we were at Elon, we felt that way, but maybe other people didn't feel that way. But social media has allowed other people to feel like African print is something they can wear daily.
Yeah, and it's more accessible. I think probably, like, Diana Swan was really cool because, like you said, she's a fashion consultant, and so she works in the corporate world, and so I loved, like, her feed, like, just the really cool designs that she had, goodness gracious, that were, you know, very fly and amazing for corporate wear, like, just really, 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 really cool designs. Like, I had major envy, like, watching her, watching her feed. I think another one that we absolutely cannot go without mentioning is Chimamanda. I know we should start a count of how many times we mentioned Chimamanda on each episode, because I'm sure, like,
The homegirl's gotta go.
I'm sure we find ways to incorporate her every now and then. But yes, she's had the Project Wear Nigeria for quite a while now, and it's a really cool initiative where she completely, so she has an Instagram where it's the comments are off, and it's managed by her nieces, I think, and it's literally just to showcase the various Nigerian designers that she wears. And I tell you, like, it is amazing. Like, so, like, when I saw her here in London, for instance, like, she was wearing the most, like, sultry yet whimsical, like, oh my goodness. Anyway, if you are not following her on Instagram, I think you should, because just the breadth and depth and variety of the designs and the designers that are showcased, like, there are lots of times where I'm like, okay, just going onto that designer's Instagram or going to their website, like, what can I get for myself? So this is all really, all really cool initiatives. And then I think, go ahead.
Yeah, and then because, like, for the reason she did that was because she wanted to spotlight by Nigerian a little bit more. Because as these fashions do go up on the global stage, there are other companies that are trying to, what's the word? I don't know. Because, okay, the thing is, African designers don't get the recognition they deserve on a global stage. So Chimamanda felt like with her platform and, you know, the, like, book signings and all the things she was doing, like, around the world, she was like, I can use my platform to highlight these Nigerian designers. Because we talk about, oh, you know, buy local, buy Nigerian, blah, blah, blah. but like, you know, everyday people don't necessarily do that. So Chimamanda mm-hmm. like took it upon herself to like champion that cause. And mm-hmm. I think it's so great because it is true that like up until recently, African designers weren't taken seriously like on the global stage and like, you know, at like, you know, the Paris Fashion Show or the New York Fashion Week or whatever, like you only recently started seeing African designers being invited to those things. And rather than like all these large companies trying to reach out to African designers and collaborate with them, you would just see these large companies like using African print and like, you know, like I know Burberry, like they got in trouble. I'm pretty sure it was Burberry. Oh my gosh, I hope I'm not wrong. But I'm pretty sure it was Burberry. They got like sued by the Maasai tribe.
You say Burberry is funny.
What?
I said the way you say Burberry is funny.
Oh, sorry. Am I pronouncing it wrong? I've never actually heard anyone else say it out loud besides me.
No. You're fine. Like I say Burberry, but I think Burberry is still fine. I think it's just really cute.
Okay. I'm not gonna be all know who I'm talking about. But basically, I read this article one time about them getting sued by the Maasai tribe because they had this like shawl that was like basically what the Maasai people wear, but they of course didn't collaborate with any Maasai people in order to come out with that line. And so you just see a lot of those different things like going on the international stage.
Yeah, I think funny enough, my mom was the one that sent this to me recently, where there's a Nigerian like designer, and once again her Instagram is to die for. I don't want to butcher her name. I think it's like Lisa Ofoyiwo. I'm so sorry. I will have we'll have her details in the show notes so you can check her out. But she essentially went to Harrods and then you snapped a picture of Stella McCartney, who had essentially had a whole line of like, you know, the kind of like, you know, in Toma dress that you're probably more West African, maybe more Ghanaian and Nigerian, that normally like your mom wears around the house to like cook or whatever. That was the whole line, but being sold for over £2,000. And then you're just like, excuse me, Stella, like who is this for? Like what is this? Like, and I think it's interesting because, you know, when it comes to African print, and it comes back to how I had said it in the beginning, what is African print? Like, we're using that term to kind of encompass like a variety of lots of really rich and really diverse local prints that come out of there. But I think that because it's like such a all encompassing term, it's very much like, well, there is no one person to attribute this particular design to or etc. So, you know, when people use it, they're just like, oh, it's just tropical or ethnic inspired print, and then people just like run with it. But it's like something like Stella, like we're saying, excuse you ma'am, like why are you selling this for £2,000 and this is our stuff? But is it really?
Right
Yeah. So
but like this stuff, like the Maasai thing, where it's like, no, like we can actually trace back like who owns that print. And so like the Maasai thing, and I'm super sorry if anybody somehow magically from Burberry was listening to this. It's not Burberry, it's Louis Vuitton. So it's Louis Vuitton that made a scarf in their like 2012 collection, I think. Some collection a while back. And they used like the Maasai like scarf and the Maasai print and everything. But of course, and they even like named it like Maasai something. And of course the Maasai didn't have like any say, didn't see any residual like profit, whatever, whatever.
No.
Yeah.
I actually remember the story. I do. Yeah. So that's obviously, I think something that's, that becomes more evident as, African print, quote unquote, like starts to take center stage. Cause for instance, like there's this another designer that I follow on Instagram called Andrea Ayama. I am like obsessed with her. So she has her swimsuit line and then she also has a bridal line and it is to die for. But like her, swimsuit line, for instance, I want to say that it was one of the, I'm pretty certain of this, that it was one of the first ones that started to incorporate, you know, different like Ankara or traditional prints. So it's not like the ones from Olori Swim, for instance, where it's full on kente, but it's ones where you can tell that the patterns are like traditionally inspired by Ankara, right, and Tomoe, whatever. But then you started to see that, like, become mainstream, quote-unquote, because then there started to be so many, like, Chinese and AliExpress rip-offs of those ones. So I think that's obviously something that becomes a bit of a concern, like, as it hits, you know, center stage, right? Because then it's easy for people to just, you know, also slap their own, come up with their own inspired version, slap their name on it.
Exactly, quote-unquote inspired. At the same time, like, I also wonder, like, this is something, like, I struggle with sometimes, like, how much can we claim Ankara specifically or, African wax fabric as our own? Because it wasn't originally African. Like, something like kente, you know, clearly, like, that one is, like, Ghanaian from Ghana. Although now the Chinese, like, you know, can make, like, machine kente. And so that's frustrating. And it's destroying the kente market in Ghana. So there's definitely some fabrics that you can be, like, you know, and in Nigeria, we have this woven fabric that's called Ashoke. Yeah, so we have that one, too. But all of us, like, all across West Africa, at least, embrace Ankara as our print. But it's not originally ours. Like, before the 1800s, you didn't see it in West Africa at all. And now it's, like, known as African print.
African print. Amalia, do you want to walk us through that?
Just because I think we all are kind of aware of the fact that it's, like, Dutch fabric or whatever. So I think that, you know, we all know, like, that African print fabric is also known as, like, you know, Dutch print fabric or, like, Hollandaise or whatever. And so we have that idea, but not all of us know, like, exactly how it became known as, like, African fabric and everything. So basically it all started in Indonesia and with the idea of batik. So the Indonesians had this method for making batik, which is, like, a printing type of thing where you have, like, wax and everything, and that's how you get the designs. But in the early 1800s, this new technology came out to be able to, like, roll the designs onto the fabric. And so different people, like Van Vlissingen, who started the Velisco company, they decided to start making this imitation batik. So they got the inspiration from the way the Indonesians made batik, and then they were able to basically, like, manufacture it instead of making it by hand like the Indonesians did. But the issue with that was that there came out with this, like, little crackle on it, and the Indonesians they didn't like it as much as their authentic batik, which didn't have that crackle. And so at the same time, as many of you know, of, like, colonization, and so that area where Indonesia was where the Dutch East Indies was. And so there were some West African soldiers that were posted to the Dutch East Indies. So, but then when they returned to their West African nations, like Ghana and stuff, they would take back either the original batik fabric, the Indonesian one, or, like, the Dutch imitation ones to, like, their wives and moms and other women in their lives. And so they would take that fabric back to West Africa. And so when the Dutch and other people saw that that imitation fabric wasn't doing well in Indonesia, like, even to the point where, like, they banned it there, they realized that there was a market for it in West Africa, because now West African women had a taste for it. And so, like, different companies popped up, but Velisco was kind of still at the head of it. This different companies popped up to, like, ship this imitation fabric to West Africa, and it was, like, a really lucrative industry. And even during World War II, the production for it in Holland, like, went down, but other places, like in London, were able to pick it up. But it's only recently in, like, the turn of the centuries, like the 2000, that Velisco has been able to, like, come back and, like, you know, put themselves back in the center of the African print conversation, and, like, you know, just come up with different designs and stuff. And so
I think
in the 1800s, when they realized that Indonesians didn't like it, but West Africans liked it, they kind of, like, adapted the colors and the designs to match the West African culture a little bit more. And so they kind of, like, realized, like, okay, like, what symbols and what different aspects, these, like, maybe, like, Ivorians preferred versus what Togolese people preferred versus what Ghanaians preferred. And so they were able to make those prints reflect that. And so that's kind of how African print fabric became known. So like that's how that Dutch made fabric became known as like West African fabric.
Yeah, so yeah. This is very much the case of being able to localize a company to the extent that there is no clear distinction between, like, with where it stops and ends in the sense of it almost seems like, because if you come to Ghana, for instance, like, we have where, like, in Kijetia, the different markets, we have where the Ntoma people are, which is where you can find the various Blisco prints, so stalls and stalls and stalls of women selling them, and it's a beautiful sight to behold. If you go on my Instagram, I think I have a picture of that. But what's interesting is that because it's you're not buying it like online or something to remind you of the fact that it is in Ghanaian and it's Dutch, you're buying it from your local cloth woman, right? Right. And so it's very much integrated into the fabric of our society. Pun.
Yeah, and also because, like, we're the ones that wear it and we're the ones that made it popular.
Yes.
And so it kind of feels our own. So that's kind of why we get, like, kind of mad when we see corporate companies who already have, like, their own thing going on, like, quote-unquote, appropriating or stealing African prints. Like, yes, African print isn't originally from Africa, but Africans made it popular.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because I think for me growing up, of course, I like never really saw anything wrong with the fact that and I mean, the thing too is that can you say there's anything wrong with it? Because a lot of these fabrics are also produced in different centers on the continent. So much so that, for instance, just before we filmed this, I was telling Malaya, I was like, yeah, you know, Blisco is like Holland, but, you know, in Ghana, we have two companies that are, you know, homegrown and local. No, those are subsidies of Blisco. I was like, oh, because we have this company.
I know, and I'm starting to wonder, like, do they own the entire market? But I do know that there are some designers out there, like African designers, who are starting to make, like, their own prints.
Yeah.
Like, not just in their own designs and stuff, but also, like, printing their fabric.
Yeah. And I guess this is something that would be really interesting to get you guys' thoughts on it, right? For something like this, where it has been so localized, and it's essentially almost like has been tailored to us, because you know the symbols are from our culture, like the messages, the color, everything has been done to suit our taste, and we very much shaped what that looks like. You know, it doesn't matter if it is a Dutch company. And then one of the things that I was reading, for instance, was like, obviously it's even though like these designs are mostly done in the design headquarters in Holland, they do employ people from the continent. So I guess it's a very interesting and nuanced subject, right? Like, it's not very black and white, like, oh my gosh, it's not African owned or blah blah blah, so blah blah blah. That was not
global thing. Yeah. It's not the most global thing there are, because it was inspired from Indonesia, made in Holland, popularized by the West Africans.
So very complex history. So what are you guys' thoughts on it? Because I know that for us as millennials, you know, some of the key trends that have been going on are being able to, like, buy black, or being able to, like, support local businesses, blah, blah, blah. So how do you feel about Blisco?
Not just Blisco, but just, African print in general as well. Like, do you think non-African designers and companies can claim it and use it? Or do you think, like, it should solely be, like, an African thing, you know? And I think it also makes it hard, like, on this point. I feel like at the beginning, African designers were only, like, recognized as African designers if they used African print. So it felt like every designer had to use African print in order to be considered an African designer. But nowadays, you see other designers who are making dresses and fabrics and outfits that don't necessarily incorporate African print. So that's been a really interesting change as well. And then another thing that's also been awesome is just the way that African designers are really just embracing and creating platforms for themselves. And so, yes, like we were saying earlier, yes, like a lot of people, didn't recognize African designers, and like they weren't on global stages. And so African people were like, okay, like we'll just make our own stages. And so you see, like, you know, the Dakar fashion show, the Lagos Fashion and Design Week that happened in October. Yeah. And then
we had a Arise.
Had an Arise fashion show in Lagos as well. So you see a lot of people who are like putting fashion shows up across the continent, but then also like having like an African fashion show in New York, African fashion show in Paris. And so taking those same African designers and putting them on international stages and local stages.
Yeah. That's been something that's been really beautiful to see, because I feel like I probably became aware of these like maybe in recent years, but I feel like each year the momentum and the turnout and the awesomeness that's displayed like only gets better and better. So I'm really, really excited.
The variety.
Yeah, the variety. Because more and more designers are starting to show their designs. You know, local models are used. It's just it's just a really, really beautiful movement to see. So I'm really excited, especially as social media influence only continues to grow. It'll be just it's an exciting thing to watch, to see, you know, how that continues to develop.
So I think there's definitely a lot more room to like advance the African fashion space, especially like, you know, how do you continue to give local designers platforms, and how do we diversify what is considered African fashion without only using African print, but then also how do we continue to localize African print so that it's not dominated, that the manufacturing of it is not dominated from abroad, but rather like localizing it. Yeah. So definitely it'd be just really interesting to see the future of African fashion and where that's going. If you guys have any thoughts, like if you have like any insider knowledge, or just, you know, your own general musings of what you, where you think the next chapter of African fashion is, like we would definitely love to know your thoughts. Like hit us up either in the comments below or like, you know, on our social media pages. We'll definitely keep conversing about this because it's a fascinating topic.
Exactly. I completely agree. So I think on that note, we're gonna end this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to us. We're really excited to share our thoughts, and we look forward to joining you on the next episode. Bye
you guys.